Good morning. Today's daf and tzuvah is Nun Aleph. We're on Nun Amud Beis. We're in the middle of the following discussion. Daughters are going to be supported by the estate. That means to say that when the father dies, so he's living over the estate. The estate is going to be inherited by the sons, not the daughters. But meanwhile, the daughters need to be taken care of. So, as part of the Tanai Ksuva, one of the conditions, stipulations of the Ksuva, so the daughters are going to be supported by the estate. With that stated, what is open to a major controversy, which we're right in the middle of, and that is that which part of the estate? Are we talking about the karka? Are we even talking about the metaltalin? So we know that a shibud is created with karka. Karka is a security. And basically what can happen is that any note holder is going to be holding a lien against the karka, but note holders are not going to be holding a lien against metaltalin, against movables. It's, basically true to this very day. In other cultures and other societies, but as far as the halacha is concerned, so that's the basic delineation, that's the demarcation that exists between property and movables. So with that stated, now the daughters are quasi lien holders, meaning that because of the ksuva, so that now they are entitled to be fed by the estate. But which portion of the estate is it just limited to the karka, which means now that the estate is going to have to sell off parcels of land in order to feed the daughters. Alternatively, even movables. So, generally speaking, movables are not held as a security against an obligation. But maybe here it's different. Maybe. So that's where the Gemara right now is in the middle of deliberating, and it's a major debate in terms of whether or not collection can be done even from metaltalin. So from here until the upcoming Mishnah, today's daf Nun Alpha Mad Alpha. When we get to the next Mishnah, until that point in time, we're going to be discussing, deliberating this very question. So, and what we saw yesterday is various Amoraim took positions in terms of whether collections are going to be done from Karka or even from Metaltalin. So now we're picking it up right where we left off yesterday. Rabbi Ami v'Rabbi Asi. So these are Amoraim. So Rabbi Ami v'Rabbi Asi, several Amazon and Metaltalin. So they thought that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to collect from Metaltalin for the support of the daughters. So Amlu Rabbi Yaakov Ba'idi, Milsat Rabbi Yochum V'Shalkish Avdu Ba'uvda, Asan Avdan Ba'uvda. And the reaction is Rav Yochanan wouldn't have done it. And Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish are not comfortable doing it, and you're comfortable doing it? Meaning I wouldn't do it if I were you. In other words, yeah, obviously collect from the estate to support the daughters, yes. But only from Karka, not from Metaltalin. Rabbi Elazar Sarvel Amezim and Metaltalin. So again, more on this topic. Rabbi Elazar also thought that he should be collecting for the daughters even for movables. Amar lefanu Rabbi Shimon ben Eliakim, Rabbi Odiani Bach Shein Midas Adina Tosei Alam Midas Rachamim. He says, look, I understand this is Rachmanus, meaning everyone's going to be very sympathetic to the girls, right? The girls who have lost a father and need to be supported, and I understand the Rachmanus, meaning that's good. That's a mida. On the other hand, over here you have to balance mida with halacha. And that is that if people see you do this, and what are they going to think? They're going to think that's a halacha. So, Elo, Shema, Yerotah, Minim, Vikbo, Lacha, Ladoros. And what's going to happen is the students are going to see you, and the students are going to think to themselves, that's the halacha. And that will be the halacha for all future generations. So, like everything in life, everything needs balancing. And over here, I understand your rachmanis towards the girls. On the other hand, you do something that is not in accordance with halacha, so people will assume that, well, that must be the halacha. So someone goes to Rav Yosef, meaning, again, in the context, we know who the someone is. So there are girls who just lost a father and are looking to collect from the estate in order to be supported. And they go to Rav Yosef because they want not only collections from Karka, but they also want collections from Metaltalin as well. And Rav Yosef says, good. So Rav Yosef, now as the dayan of this particular case, so he says, collect. Collect me tamri da al budja. You go ahead and you collect from the dates that are on top of the budja. Budja, some sort of mat that was used in order to collect the dates, meaning when the dates fell from the tree, so they laid mats right below the tree that collected the dates. And so they were talking now about dates, but after being detached from the tree, otherwise known in halach as metaltalin. Good. So go collect from the dates. So am le abaye ilu ba chov hava ki agavna mi haviyav le amar. And so in attendance of this court case was Abaye, who was a contemporary of Rav Yosef, right? Often debated with Rav Yosef. Abaye says to Rav Yosef, what are you doing? What are you doing? If it was a regular creditor and he was looking to collect, and again, the person defaulted. So on a in the case of a regular creditor, so now he can come and collect what? Property, but that's it. In other words, a creditor can't collect movables for his loan. The only thing that is securing the loan is only properties. You wouldn't collect dates for a regular creditor. So why should this case be any different? So Amalei Dechazi Lebuja Kamina. So Rav Yosef says, no, I was misunderstood, misquoted, whatever the case is. In other words, I didn't mean the dates that were actually fell off the tree. I mean the dates that are about to fall off the tree. That's what I'm talking about. Sof, the Gemara says, and Nun Alf Amud Alf, very top of the Amud. Sof, Kol HaOmid Ligzos Kegozos Dami. So we have a general principle of anything that is about to fall off is viewed as if it already fell off again. Again, this is general halachic principles that has multiple applications, but we'll obviously just limit our comments to our case over here. And that is that when the dates are fully ripe and ready to come off the tree, halacha views them as if they already came off the tree. So in other words, fully ripened dates on the tree have the status of metaltalin, not of karka, and so it doesn't make a difference. Even if it didn't actually fall off the tree, halacha views them as if they did, and therefore it's metaltalin. So de tricha ledikla kamina. So Rav Yosef one more time clarifies what he meant. What he meant was not the fully ripened dates, but in other words, the dates that still need the tree, i.e., they were not fully ripened. And since they were not fully ripened, they're part and parcel of the tree. Therefore, it has the status of karka. Those dates can be collected for the support of the daughters. Adkan. Not yet. We're not done yet. But in other words, for whatever reason, we've got two dots here in the Gemara. But the we could pause for just a moment. So we're in the middle of a really heated debate. We ended off yesterday's daf in this debate, and we're continuing picking it up in today's daf right where we left off yesterday. Should the daughters who are entitled to mezonos, the estate is required to support the daughters as part of the Tanai Ksuva. So can they be, by the way, we point this out already. I'm just reminding everyone, until they get married. Once they get married, that's it. The estate no longer is obligated to support them. But this requirement to support the daughters is going to be coming from what source? What source of the estate? Is it karka? Is it metaltalin? So generally speaking, those note holders are able to collect from karka and not from metaltalin. Maybe the daughters are different. And what we're hearing now, numerous different ways, is that this is a heated, debated issue in terms of whether collections can be done even from metaltalin. It is not normal for note holders to be collecting from metaltalin. Okay, but maybe the daughters we're going to be more sympathetic towards. Okay, and mind you, right? You could see that you could see this tension in the Gemara in terms of whether or not we should be sympathetic. You're going to see this tension exist. Well, I'll be clear about that in just a couple minutes from now. We just have a little bit more Gemara that we need to finish up on. Hahu Yaslom, V'yasoma Dasa L'kama D'Rava. Okay, so there were orphans, Yaslom and Yasoma, and they came to Rava. Now, it happens to have been a boy and a girl. They're brother and sister. And they go to Rava. Now, as far as the boy's concerned, why is he going to Rava? Meaning, right, he's the Yerush. He's the one who's inheriting the estate. So presumably what's happening over here, and it's pretty clear from the context of our Gemara, is that they are minors. Both of them are minors. And as far as the Yosam is concerned, right now, he is not the trustee of the estate. Somebody else, there's an apotropos who was entrusted over the estate, and he is allocating towards the Yosam and towards the Yosama. So Amalu Rava, so Rava says, oh, look, I got a great idea. And that is the following. As far as the Yosam is concerned, so there are no limits, there's no caps in terms of what he's going to be collecting from the estate. Meaning, yes, there's a apotropos, there's some sort of guardian who is in charge of the estate, but he has no limits, no caps whatsoever towards the boy. He can give the boy karka, he can give the boy metaltalin, no problem whatsoever. So Rava says, I have a great idea. And that is that give the boy both karka and metaltalin, and then she can get the metaltalin via the boy. No, okay, fine. So he will be now, and I understand this is what's called the loophole. This is a pretty good example of a loophole, and that is that basically the metaltalin will be funneled through the boy. Okay. So hallelujah, Mishul Yosoma. And now, as far as the accounting is concerned, so what basically he'll do is he'll hire the girl. He'll hire his sister. Okay? Good. And now she's able to get the metaltalin from the estate via this maneuver of Rava. Okay, brilliant. Sure. So Armale Rabban La Rava Vahamar Hudamar Mekarke Vlam Matate Ben Lamazoni Ben Luxuva Ben La Parnasa. Now, when this psak of Rava became popular and people were talking about it, so somebody comes over to Rava and says, I don't understand. That's wildly inconsistent. You're the one who says that in terms of the collections of Mizonos and Ksuva and Parnasa, regarding all those, you have said that they're only going to be collected from Karka and not from Mizonos. Sorry. And not from Metaltalin. Okay, and so now we're like, what are you doing? And Rava, in his defense, basically says, I think this is a perfectly legitimate loophole. Meaning, I just came up with a good idea. Meaning, I'm not inconsistent. Meaning, I consistently say that the daughters can only be supported by Karka, not by Metaltalin. That part's true. But okay, but the son has no cap. There's no limit from the son. The son is getting Yerusha. In other words, and I understand, it's being, right now, it's being overseen by a guardian, by a custodian. But it doesn't matter. The son can get whatever he wants. He can get Karka and get Metaltalin. And now, he wants to hire somebody to help him out. He can hire whoever he wants. It happens to be he's hiring his sister. Okay. And you know what? In other words, twofold over. Number one, in other words, he's getting service. Number two is that she's also now be able to get Metaltalin. But I think this is a perfectly legitimate loophole. Rava just shrugs his shoulders and says, look, I'm not inconsistent. This is a viable way to be able to give her some of the Metaltalin of the estate. All right, Tana Rabbanan. Okay, so now not only is this a machlokas amongst the Amoraim, it's also a machlokas amongst the Tanaim as well, right? Somehow, in other words, this issue which we've been deliberating, so we've been quoting Amoraim back and forth, Rav Yosef, Rav, Reish Lakish, Rav Yochanan, right? All your major Amoraim on this topic. I don't know why. In other words, the Gemara presents now the Tanaim at the back end of the entire sugya. So organizationally, I'm a little bit confused over here in terms of why it is that we're only hearing the Tanaim at the end of the entire sugya. Regardless, okay. So here are the Tanaim, and Rabbi's of the position that as far as Mazon Isha is concerned, as far as Mazon Banos are concerned, so they're collecting from Nechasim Sheyesh Lahem Achrayus. That's called Karka. That's another way to describe Karka. And Nechasim She'in Lahem Achrayus. That's another way to describe Metaltalin. So according to Rabbi, Mazon Bito is coming from both. And Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar amen nechasim sheishal machrayes motzim lebanos minabanim ulevanos minabanos ulebanim minabanim ulebanim ulebanim minabanos benechasim merubim. So as far as Karka is concerned, so Karka now from Karka we're going to be able to support the daughters. Now there are multiple permutations of how exactly we're going to be extracting money from one person to another. And I'm not going to go through every permutation right now. Suffice to say that for Muslim Banos, we are simply collecting, but only from property, not from movables. But what if it's not Chasim Muatim? Meaning if the estate is so small, and we described a small estate. In other words, a state that can't even support the kids for 1 year. Right, that is what halachically is referred to as nechas muatim. We have learned together that by nechas muatim, so what happens? So even though the Torah declares that the sons are going to inherit, but over here, not even going to be that money's not even going to be lasting a year. Someone's going to have to go knocking door to door to collect. So the chachamim decided. It's a terrible decision, but no, sorry, the decision's not terrible. It's a terrible decision to have to make, and that is that look. In other words, resources are limited. And so we're going to say that the girls are going to get the limited resources, and the boys are going to go knocking door to door. Okay, good. So that's nechasim muatim. So in the case of nechasim muatim, so all the limited resources are going to the girls, not to the boys. However, nechasim shein lamachrayes motzim labanim minabanos ulavanos minabanos ulavanim minabanos aval ulavanos minabanim. And then when it comes to movables. So movables, so that is not used for Mizonos. And again, I know there are many permutations of this point, but overall, the larger point of the Gemara is that we are not collecting movables for the girls because movables are not used towards Mizonos Abbas. Okay, so what comes out over here? Machlokas HaTanayim. So not only is it a Machlokas Amoraim, which has really been occupying most of our time, most of the real estate in the Gemara has been dedicated to the Machlokas amongst the Amoraim, but on top of that, it's also Machlokas Tanaim as well, between Rebbe and Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Now, Avagab de Kamalan Halacha Rabbi Mechavero. And now the Gemara says, okay, now we're coming to a conclusion on this matter. And normally, what do we say? That when you have a machlokus between Rebbe and a colleague, so the halacha normally follows like Rebbe, which means now that we would at this point in time rule that the daughters are going to be supported not only by Karka, but by Metaltalin as well. However, hacha halacha k'Rebbe Shimon ben Elazar, d'ama Rava, hilchasa mimekarki v'lo mimetaltalin, bein l'ksuva, bein l'mazoni, bein l'mparnasa. But over here, we pass on like Rebbe Shimon ben Elazar. Why? Because Rava said it. Rava said that when it comes to the collection for three things. Number one, ksuva. Number two, mizonos. And three, parnasa. Okay, so ksuva over here probably means ksuva proper, meaning the settlement payment that she gets at the conclusion of a marriage, either through death or divorce. So ksuva over here probably means that. Again, ksuva is a very generic term that could mean different things in different contexts of the Gemara, but over here probably that's what ksuva means. And then as far as mizonos are concerned, support. Support for the widow, support for the daughters. So that's coming also only from Karka. And finally, Parnasa. Parnasa over here means an adunya. That's a dowry. So when allocating from the estate towards the daughter so that she can get married. And remember, had there been a father, he would have given a sum of money to kickstart the marriage. But now that there is no father, so what we're going to have to do is assess how much the father would have given. And as a result of that, so when it comes to the Parnasa, the dowry, the nedunya, so that too is only going to be collected from Karka. The Gemara's conclusion is really clear. And that is that for all these obligations, ksuva, mizonos, and Parnasa, for all these obligations, they're only to be collected from Karka and not from Metaltalin, in contrast to the position of Rebbe, who says that's collected from Metaltalin, and also in deference to the position of, not in deference, but despite the fact that many Amoraim are of the position that you should be collecting from even Metaltalin. Even Rava, by the way, who this is Rava's psak, meaning this is Rava's conclusion, even Rava himself, we saw just minutes earlier today, where Rava found a way to be able to get Metaltalin over to the daughter. But Me'ikar Hadin, according to the strict letter of the law, she can only collect from Karka, not from Metaltalin. Okay, which brings us to one more chapter in this saga. Meaning we spent a good part of yesterday and so for half of today's daf, going over this topic of we have an estate and the daughters need to be supported and which part of the estate can be used towards the support of the daughter. And the Gemara's conclusion, after a lengthy discussion, is pretty clear. There is one more chapter, and that is the Gaonim. So the Gaonim stepped in. You see Tosfos over here quotes it, the second Tosfos on the Amud. And a number of Rishonim quote it, and that understandably, meaning because the Gaonim really felt this way, and they ruled, and that is that B'tkufas HaGaonim. So the period of the Gaonim takes us now, basically from the end of the Gemara until the Rishonim, about 500 years, a lengthy period of time. And at some point during the Tkufa of the Gaonim said that when it comes to now taking money from the estate to support the daughters, so that's going to be collected afilu mimetautalei. Despite the fact, it's an interesting case study, despite the fact that the Gemara is very, very conclusive in its decision, nevertheless, the Gaonim overturned the Gemara's ruling. And the Gaonim said that they're going to be collecting even from Metaltalin. Okay, in terms of what got them to that point. So Tosfos over here discusses it oh so little, but there's a little bit here in Tosfos that discusses it. But anyway, that is the next chapter on this discussion of what to collect for the daughters, for Mizonos Abbas.
Basin Hefka.
He doesn't say that, but the again, Tosfos says very little. He quotes a Gaonim. He doesn't do much in terms of explaining. I could take guesses. I'd rather not. We moved away from being property owners. Right. It's probably. Right. As guesses go, by the way, I like that guess. Okay, could be right. Okay. Locus of Luxuva. Okay, here we are. Okay, so now we find ourselves in the Mishnah on right in the middle of Nun Aleph Amud Aleph, and we're back to the basics over here. Okay, so again, I know we're halfway through the Masechta, but here we are learning some very basic information regarding the base minimum of Luxuva. Again, so the Luxuva, as we've discussed now, time and again since the beginning of the Masechta, but since the beginning of the Masechta, we got a little bit sidetracked with other topics and discussions. But the Ksuva is an IOU if in the event that upon death or divorce, so I'm going to be owing you a fixed amount of money, a settlement payment. Okay, this is the ksuva is the original prenuptial agreement made between husband and wife. And how much is the ksuva going to be for? So there is a base minimum amount, which we discussed already since the beginning of the Masechta. So for a besula, if he's marrying a besula, the base minimum amount is going to be 200 zuz. And if it's not a besula, it's going to be 100 zuz. And I know earlier in the Masechta, we talked about who's a besula, who's a be'ula, what about a mukas eitz. So that we discussed in the beginning. What we're going to be discussing right now, here in this Mishnah, on Nun Aleph, a little bit less than halfway through the Masechta, what we're going to be discussing now is, are these guidelines? Are these hard numbers over here? Meaning, when we say 200 zuz, it has to be base minimum 200 zuz? What if she's okay with less? So, lo kasav laksuva besula gova masayim va'amana manim imneshu tanai beisdin. So, the Mishnah says, now it's an anonymous Mishnah, and a couple minutes from now, we're going to be identifying who the author of our Mishnah is, because we're going to see that there is a machlokas, but we'll get to that in just a moment. Right now, as far as our Mishnah is concerned, so our Mishnah is of the position that it's going to be base minimum amounts. These are hard numbers. 200 zuz, 100 zuz, and even if not written in the ksuva, it is the base minimum. 200 for a besula, 100 for an almana. It's part of Tanai Beisdin, meaning that there are certain parts of a ksuva which are fundamental. And even if you don't see them in writing, a ksuva by its very nature is going to demand these base minimum amounts. So kasav la sada shava mana tachas masaim zuz, velo kasav la kol nechasim di isle achrayin l'ksuva sach, chayv shu tanai beisdin. Now let's say he only secured one parcel of his properties towards the ksuva. Under such, and it happens to be that parcel was only worth 100 zuz. And again, the ksuva itself is face value, valued at 200 zuz. So, and he didn't write in the ksuva that all my properties are going to be mortgaged against the ksuva obligation. So the Mishnah says all the properties are going to be mortgaged against, are going to be held against the ksuva obligation. And she has a lien on all of his properties, even though in the ksuva, only one of the properties were identified. And why? And again, Tanai Beisdin. Because this is the very nature and fabric of a ksuva. And that the ksuva, she is a note holder. She has a lien against any and all of his properties. And even if only one of the properties is highlighted, is mentioned in the ksuva, doesn't matter. Lo kasav la im tishtab I efar kanech. Let's say he doesn't write the following in the ksuva, that if in fact you are held captive, I'm going to ransom you and I'll bring you back home. I'll bring you back to our house. So even if that's not written in the ksuva, once again, tonight ksuva. And over kohanis adrinach le medina sech. Now, if he's married to a, if he's a kohen, obviously meaning she's married to a kohen, so the language of the ksuva is going to sound a little bit different. Because if she's taken into captivity, so Rachmanus, she can't go back to him. But he still has an obligation to ransom her. And what he's going to do after he ransoms her is that now he's going to bring her back to her parents' home. Meaning Rachmanus, he's going to have to divorce her and the marriage is going to terminate. But his ksuva obligation forces him to have to ransom her. So Shehu Tanai Beisdin. Once again, these are basic requirements of a ksuva, even if not in writing. This is demanded of every marriage. It's built into the marriage. It's built into the ksuva. And remember, we already discussed earlier, back on Daf Mem Zayin, that the pirkuna, that his obligation to redeem her, is going to be in exchange for peros. Peros, that's the dividends, the fruit that he's entitled to. So for that entitlement, so he also has the obligation of redeeming her. Nishbeis chayv levdosa. So let's say she's taken captive, so he is obligated to redeem her. Now, I know that sounds repetitive, but the Mishnah here is about to make a point, and that is, im amahare gita uksuva savatif desatzma. Let's say he basically says, I'm out. In other words, now at this point in time, it's going to cost me money to have to redeem you. I got a better idea. And that is that I'll divorce you. And obviously the divorce is going to, I know, yeah. The right, the divorce is obviously going to have to force me to pay out the settlement, the ksuva settlement. Okay. But I'd rather that than have to ransom you. Okay. Right, it doesn't speak well about their marriage and the relationship. I understand that. The point of the Mishnah over here, the Mishnah is just talking about responsibilities and obligations. And the Mishnah says that's simply not an option. In other words, his obligation to ransom her cannot be transferred over into any other type of settlement. It is simply an obligation to ransom her, and he is not off the hook from that. So Eina Rashai, he has no right to do that. Now, Lakta Chayv L'Raposa. Now, if, let's say, she's sick, so he has an obligation now to pay for the medical bills. Again, that is part of the Suva obligation. Now, this is news to us, meaning, now, it's intuitive, right, please understand, meaning, as a husband, it's understandable that he's going to be now saddled with the responsibility of having to pay the medical bills, but it makes sense. Why does it make sense? So Rashi over here writes, it makes sense because what do we know? That he has an obligation to feed her, to support her. Rashi says that refuah is mizonos, meaning they are under the same category. Once he has an obligation to support her, so he also has an obligation to live a healthy life. And so, right, it's all part of the health benefits, so to say, that she has being married to him. Good. So now here, he can opt out. Meaning what he can do over here is they say the following. The medical bills are overwhelming me. And again, doesn't speak well about their marriage, but again, I'm not here for the counseling aspect of today's daf. I'm here just for the financial obligations. Here he does have options. If he wants to divorce her and say, look, I'm going to write, I know the divorce is going to require me to pay you ksuva. I'd rather that than have to pay all the medical bills. Here he does have the right to do so. No, right. In other words, no, but the chiddush is that this is in contradistinction to the redeeming. Meaning by the redeeming, he does not have that option. So the Mishnah here is contrasting. So she's taken captivity, he can't opt out. But here he can opt out. Exactly. Exactly the point. Now, money. Okay, so our first discussion, we're gonna have a couple discussions from here until the end of today's daf. Right? Our last discussion is going to be unbelievably indelicate. Okay, good. We have a lot to look forward to. But before we get there, oh my gosh, that last discussion today is really going to be tough. But before we get there, the first thing that we're going to be doing today is identifying who the author of our Mishnah is. Okay, this is a classic discussion to be had. Well, first we have to know that there are multiple positions, and once we learn that together, so then we're going to learn who is the author of our Mishnah. It's going to be a little bit tricky because our Mishnah seems to be going in different directions. So money, Rabbi Meir, he damer kol apoches lebesul me'masayim alamana mimane, hareze bi'ilaz nus. So first of all, the beginning of our Mishnah is going like Rabbi Meir, because Rabbi Meir is of the position that if your ksuva is going to be anything less than 200 zuz for besula, or anything less than 100 zuz for an amana, so that's not a ksuva. And the bi'ila that you're having with her is bi'ilaz nus. It's out of the context of marriage. Meaning a ksuva cannot be less than 200 or 100. Okay. So, D.E. Rabbi Yehuda, Hamar Rasa because according to Rabbi Yehuda, what she could do is she could waive. In other words, he writes her ksuva of 200, and she could write a receipt that I received 100. And Rashi writes over here, even if she didn't receive 100. In other words, she's waiving 100 zuz. She could do that. According to Rabbi Yehuda. So, if I ask you now who the author of our Mishnah is, our Mishnah is viewing the numbers as hard numbers, right? Non-negotiables. So then it sounds like our Mishnah is going like Rabbi Meir. Fine. Ema Seifa. It's fine up until you get to the next part of the Mishnah. Kasav Lasad Shavim Mana Tachas Masayim Zuz Velo Kasav Kol Nechasim Dislach Achrein Luxuvasai Chayiv Shehu Tanai Beizdin Asan LaRabbi Yehuda. But then the next part of the Mishnah, that's difficult. Because what does the Mishnah say? He only secures one land against the ksuva. What do we know? What did our Mishnah teach us? All of his properties are secured against the ksuva. Mazel tov. Meaning because even though not stated clearly in the ksuva, but that's the definition of a ksuva. She's a note holder. She's going to be holding a lien against all of his properties, even though that wasn't written in the ksuva. Who's that? Gemara says, I'll tell you who that is. That's Rabbi Yehuda. Damar achrayas tal soferhu. Meaning according to Rabbi Yehuda, if Achrayas was not written into the star, blame the sofer. Now, when I say blame the sofer, I just simply mean that was an error, right? That omission was an oversight by the sofer. But in other words, but even though it's not there, it's understood that it's there. The E Rabbi Meir Hamar Achrayas Laftao Sofer Hu, because according to Rabbi Meir Achrayas Laftao Sofer Hu, meaning that if let's say in a note it omits the fact that properties are going to be secured against the note, even though it doesn't say that, according to Rav Meir, it's understood. And its omission is, and I'm sorry. According to Rav Meir, if it's not there, it's not an oversight. Meaning, according to Rav Meir, only that which is written in the document is enforceable. Anything that is left out of the document is not enforceable, and we don't just simply say it was an oversight. So now, did none, and I know that because of the following Mishnah. So let's say you find a note in the street and you would like to do the right thing, and that is return it to its owner. Now, here's the problem. And that is that here the story behind this note could be the following. It could be that the note was already paid up and the note was returned back to the borrower. Now, what the borrower should have done immediately upon receiving the note is he should have tore it up. He should have destroyed it. Okay? He lost it. Okay? It happens. So Matzei Sharichov said, now the finder wants to do the right thing. So, Im Yesh Bahem Achreis Nechasim Lo Yachzir Shebeis Din Nifraim Mehem Ein Bahem Achreis Nechasim Yachzir Shein Beis Din Nifraim Mehem Divrei Rebbe Meir. So according to Rebbe Meir, it depends. If you're reading the note, and in the note it writes Achreis Nechasim that my lands are going to be secured against this note, so now you can't return this note. Why not? Because we're worried about the following. A little bit of a conspiracy, if you will. In that the borrower and the lender, in other words, the borrower already satisfied the note, but he says to the lender, "Hey, I got this great idea," and that is that. Look, there are properties that I sold off. I really want them back. So we'll lose the note. Somebody will pick it up. Somebody will return it to you, right? The lender. And now you're going to take me to court, and I'm going to default on the loan. And we'll be able to go back and we'll be able to collect those properties from the people that we stole, that I sold it to. Okay? And they'll make such a scheme. They'll make such a plot. In halacha, it's what's called a kanunya. Yeah, it's called fraud. Right? Very good. So, no, that's good. That's accurate. So as a result of that, so according to a mayor, if achrais is written into the document, so then you can't do it because we're worried about such a scheme. On the other hand, if achrais is not written in the document, so we don't have to worry about scheming. Okay, so that's Rabbi Meir. Because Rabbi Meir is of the position that we read the document, whatever's in is in, and whatever's not in there, we don't assume it's an oversight. In other words, it was deliberately left out. That's Rabbi Meir. And v'chachamim omrim, and the chachamim over here is synonymous with Rabbi Yehuda, v'chachamim omrim echazeh v'echazeh lo yachzir shebeis din nifraim mehem. And the chachamim say, no, don't return the note. Because even though achrais was not written in the document, we assume it's an oversight. Meaning every note is going to be held, the properties of the borrower are going to be held as security against a note. And that's assumed in every single document, written or not written. Okay. So where does that leave us? We have a machlokes between Rav Yehuda and the Chacham. Sorry. We have a machlokes between Rav Yehuda and Rav Meir, whether or not the omission is considered a Torah sofer or not considered a Torah sofer.
Right. You mean to say Beis is not going to make him make a shruah regarding?
No, if you're bringing a note into Beis Din saying that you're owed money.
Yeah, but the property was sold.
Correct. I know. So, okay.
You know, in order to avoid fraud like that, don't they do something to make sure that the...
Generally speaking, when you're coming into Beis Din with a note, so that note is basically your proof. That's your evidence that you're owed money. In other words, you're going to put more. You're going to let's discuss a little bit more later. But if you're going to put more regulation on the note holder in order to collect, so what's going to happen?
Not on the note holder, necessarily, but on the seller, he's making certain disclosures that he doesn't owe any money.
Okay,
on
fine.
The property.
Okay, you're in the business. You know this much better than I do. Okay, but the basic idea is that we're worried about scheming. Anyway, let's go back to our sugya. So within our sugya now, so I look at the end of our Mishnah. The end of our Mishnah says is that even if everything is not written out in the ksuva, it's an oversight, meaning it's there. In other words, even if you don't see it, omission is not considered an oversight. That's our Mishnah. And that's the sheet of Rabbi Yehuda. And so now as you're following our Mishnah, so it's not a straight line going down, meaning the beginning of the Mishnah is going like Rabbi Meir. The end of the Mishnah is going like Rabbi Yehuda. Okay, and that was what's called inconsistent. And the Gemara obviously is uncomfortable with that. So the Reisha Rav Meir v'sefer Rabbi Yehuda v'chitei machkula Rabbi Meir hi v'shan l'Rav Meir ben ksuv l'shtarei. And the Gemara says, and I know what you're thinking. And you're thinking that maybe the entire Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, and maybe there is a difference between a general note versus a ksuva. Maybe ksuva operates differently than a general note, right? And maybe you're thinking like that. The Gemara says, okay, it's not a terrible thought, but you're not right. So, umi shani la vehatanya. The Gemara says, I'm going to quote you a brisa. The brisa here could not be any clearer, and that is, chamisha govim min amechorarim ve'elohein. Five people are going to be collecting, but only from properties that are free and clear, meaning properties that you currently own, but not from properties that you sold off. And that is, peros v'shvach peros mekaba alav lazonis ben ishto ubas ishto v'ger chov shein bo achrayis v'ksuvas isha shein bo achrayis. Okay, so, various obligations. Now, please, I'm going to ask you to forgive me. I'm not going to explain all of them. The peros shvach peros. When we get to Gittin, when we get to Bamitzia. So I will explain both of them in more detail. But whatever. The point is that the last two examples over here is that if I have a regular note, right? That is, the Gemara describes it over here as a get, but get over here just simply means a note, right? A get chov. If you have just a regular note. Alternatively, if you have ksuvas isha and neither of them have achrayus, meaning it's omitted from the document. So what's the halacha? The halacha is very clear. And that is it. You can only collect from properties that are currently held by the borrower. But you can't go after sold properties because there was no lien attached to the note. In other words, it was omitted from the note. Now it says over here of the two examples, a regular note and a ksuva. Obviously, according to Rabbi Yehuda, there's no difference. According to Rabbi Meir. So, man shamas leidamer chayes lav tafet sofer Rabbi Meir v'ketani ksuvas isha. Okay, and it says ksuvas isha. Sorry, I meant Rabbi Meir. So, according to Rabbi Meir, omission is not an oversight, and there is no distinction between a regular note and a ksuva. Okay, so where are we right now? The inconsistency of our Mishnah. The opening of our Mishnah is going like Rabbi Meir that the numbers 200 and 100 are absolutes, meaning those are hard numbers. And you cannot negotiate with those numbers. You can't go anything less than that. That's Rabbi Meir. But then when you get to the end of the Mishnah, where the end of the Mishnah is talking about omission being an oversight or not being an oversight, our Mishnah is of the position that omission is an oversight. And even though it only says that one of his properties are mortgaged against the obligation, all the properties are mortgaged against the obligation. And that cheats us Rabbi Yehuda, not cheats us Rabbi Meir. Okay, so where are we? Confused. So, So the Gemara says, okay, I can clean up the Mishnah in one of two ways. Okay, very simple. And that is that as far as our Mishnah is concerned, in the entirety of the Mishnah is going like Rabbi Yehuda. So the end of the Mishnah is going like Rabbi Yehuda that we've already established. The beginning of the Mishnah could also be going like Rabbi Yehuda. In that, what in the beginning of the Mishnah, what happened? He wrote her a ksuva for 200, as he should. She can then forgive it, but only after he writes a ksuva for 200. That's acceptable. But I'll tell you what's not acceptable, writing a ksuva at the origination for anything less than 200. That you can't do. Oh, okay, fine. That could be Shitas Rabbi Yehuda, and that could be our Mishnah, and that means that our entire Mishnah is going like Rabbi Yehuda. Alternatively, Ibaizim Rabbi Meir, and my Chayiv Diktani Minam Echurarim. Or it could be that our Mishnah is going like Rabbi Meir. Our Mishnah says that you're Chayiv, And according to Rabbi Meir, omission is not an oversight. And so if omission is not an oversight, so that means to say you don't have a lien on the property. If you don't have a lien on the property, so how can the wife collect? The answer is very simple. She's not collecting from properties that are sold. She's collecting from holdings that are currently being held by her husband. That's what the Mishnah means. Okay. Again, If the ksuva, according to Rabbi Meir, only if the ksuva wrote that down. But if the ksuva did not have that in writing, so then that omission is not an oversight. Again, we don't pasken. In other words, correct. It's a machlokas, in other words. And
this goes back to what we learned yesterday, which is regarding if he gives away the land to his kids, and if he no longer owns the property, she still has a lien against it.
Correct. The halacha is, right, sorry for the confusion, the halacha is that she has a lien on the property. And the only thing that we're discussing right now is that if that wasn't written to the ksuva, is it understood that that's part of the ksuva contract? That's all we're discussing right now. That's a machlokas. Our Mishnah seems to be taking a position, but then the inconsistency in the Mishnah and the Gemara's attempt to just simply smooth out the Mishnah. So that Mishnah is either following all like Rameir or like Rabbi Yehuda. Okay. All right, our last discussion for today. Let's go. Okay, and as I pointed out, this is an extraordinarily indelicate discussion to be had, and it's going to be tough. But Torah, it's all part and parcel of Torah, and we'll have it. This is I'm speaking to adults, and so this is adult conversation to say the very least. So lo kasav la am amar avur dishmol eshes yisrael shenensa asur labala. Avur dishmol takes the position that's the following: a woman's violated, so she will be prohibited to her husband, not just a kohen, which even if she's Eishes Yisrael, she'll be prohibited to her husband. Why? Because even though at the beginning of the act she was violation and she did not want to participate, but then she then became a beratzon. Her attitude changed and she then became a willing participant in the act. So Eisvei Rav LaAvua D'Shmuel. So when Rav hears this, he has a hard time understanding this. So Im Tishbiyeh Farkanechvos Vechlech Leinso. So he says, "Can I remind you of our Mishnah? Meaning, remember what we learned just 20 minutes ago, 25 minutes ago, and that is that in our Mishnah we learned together that as part of the Ksuva contract, you're taken into captivity. I'm going to redeem you, and I'm going to bring you home and bring you back to my house. And the assumption is that during captivity she was violated. Okay, but that's Ones. And according to you, every Ones starts off as Ones but ends off as Ratzon. How do you understand the language of the Ksuva? It's a strong question. So Kar Rav Ala Davu Dishmol Sarim Asar Bimilim Vikaf Simulapim. And so a pasuk in Eov, the basic idea of the pasuk is that sometimes you just shut your mouth and you don't give an answer, and you could have given an answer, but sometimes you don't. Okay. So my Israel Lameimar. Now, what could have Avu Dishmol said? He could have said the following. Bishvuya hikilu. In other words, don't give me the Mishnah. Don't give me the case of a woman taken into captivity. A woman taken into captivity, so we don't know that she was violated. In other words, there are assumptions that are made that she's violated. But as we've discussed already a number of times, there are kulas when it comes to a shvuya. Remember, Eid Echad, other kulas as well. So you're giving me the example of shvuya. That's not a good example. Meaning, what Avu D'Shmuel is, what I'm telling you is that if we know that she was violated, so then what we assume is that it's Tchilaso Be'ones, the sofa viratzon. And the Mishnah obviously is not talking about where we know she was violated. It's only a concern. Ula avua d'shmuel, ones d'sharya rechman ehech mishkachala. So now, according to avua d'shmuel, what's a case of ones? There has to be a case of ones. The Torah describes ones. And according to you, avua d'shmuel, every single ones starts off that way but ends off viratzon. Meaning, but there has to be a case of ones. So the kagon, the kamri edim, shetzavsa, and so the case of Ones would be is that she is crying and screaming in protest from the beginning to the end, and the Edom are testifying to that. So Upligi de Rava. Okay, now this position of Avu D'Shmuel, which is really, really difficult, but it's a Shita. So this is in contradistinction to the Shita of Rava. Rava says no. So Rav is of the position that a woman who was violated, and even if she says crazy things at the end, right? Let's say, for example, she says at the end of the act, like, leave him alone. I would have even paid for this. She's saying crazy things at the end. Rav says it doesn't matter. In other words, we call that ones. And she's mutter to her husband. My time, yes, or Abasha. Because at that point in time, meaning in the act itself, so the Eitz Hara becomes so strong that she's no longer lucid. She's no longer saying things that she really believes. The Eitz Hara at this point in time is just too powerful. Tanya Kavase de Rava, the Gemara supports Rava. So the Hilon is Pasa Asura. So a woman who was not taken, she was not violated. So if she was not violated, she's Asura. So Hanis Pasa Muteris. So that means to say that if she was violated, then she's mutter to her husband. So Yeshacha Cher Shafa Pishalon is Pasa Muteris. And there is an example that where even though she wasn't violated, she's mutter to her husband. What in the world could that be referencing? So Ve'eta Zeh Kol Shetz Chalas Bonus V'Sofa Baratzon. The Brisa says it. The Brisa says that at first she was taken against her will, but then over the course of the act, She then says that I'm interested in this. So even under those circumstances, the Braisa says that qualifies as ones. She's mutter to her husband. Tanya presented another Braisa of Hilon Nispasa Asura. Han Nispasa Mutarsi Eshacha Chers Shalfa Pishin Nispasa Asura. A woman who was taken against her will, she's going to be prohibited to her husband. Vezezuzu Eshes Kohen, that's as we've discussed already time and again through this Masechta, the previous Masechta, that's talking about Eshes Kohen. I'm Rabbi Yehuda, I'm Rabbi Shmuel, Mishum Rabbi Shmuel, V'hilon Nispasa Asura, Han Nispasa Mutaris, V'yeshecha Acher Sha'af Api Shlo Nispasa Mutaris, V'yezezuzu Kedusha, Shekedusha Kedusha Taos. Okay, let's say the marriage was done, but on a condition. And the condition was not met. So under those circumstances, when the marriage is conditional and the condition is not met, so then lima frere retroactively, the condition is undone. And let's say they're married for some time. Let's say she has a child from the marriage. So she could just simply walk away from the marriage. Because again, it's a conditional condition and the condition wasn't satisfied. Okay, retroactively, it's undone. I'm Rav Yehuda. One more point for today. Hani neshe deganvu ganave. Sorry. Women were kidnapped. And sharon le guvrayu. So they when finally released from the ganavim, so they can go back to their husbands. So I'm le rabban le rav yudavaka mematina le nama. So the Gemara says, yeah, but you know what? In other words, during captivity, they're serving their captors bread. So mach masira. The Gemara says, "Yeah, that's because they're terrified." And v'haka mishachin lehu gerei. They're sharpening the arrows. The Gemara says, "Yeah, mach masira." Again, that's because they're terrified. V'hashavkin v'azal minavshayu asirin. However, if after their release they go back to the captors at that point in time, it's no longer onis. At that point in time, it's ratzon. And yes, we're all thinking about Stockholm syndrome over here. But the assumption is that when they go back to their captors, when they have a perfect choice of going and leaving them, the Gemara assumes that it's that's because they're baratzon. Tana Rabbanan Shavuya Machos Harein Kishuin Genuve Listos. Kishuin Genuve Listos in a Kishvuyim. So over here, a distinction to be made between women who were taken captive by a king versus women who were taken captive by robbers. That and in the first case, they are considered ones. In the second case, they're considered baratzon. So the Hatanya Ebcha, we have a brisa that says just the opposite. So machus amachus lo kasha haba machus achashver shaba machus ben netzer. So it depends which melech we're talking about. If we're talking about the melech achashverosh, so the melech achashverosh, so they are considered captives, meaning this melech has total authority and they don't have any choice in the matter, and so therefore that's considered an act of onyx. On the other hand, if we're talking about Ben Netzer, unclear exactly what Ben Netzer is making reference to, the Rishonim discuss it. Anyway, it's a king with less authority. We could say, right? We could just simply say that. So that's something where he does not have total control and total authority, and them being now subject to his wills, meaning that they're not onis. So listos alistos lokasha haba ben etzer haba listem dalma. So the Gemara says, now as far as listos is concerned, so the contrast between the listem of ben etzer versus just a regular listem. Well, ben etzer hasem kari le melech v'hachi kari le listem. Confusing, right? Ben etzer is on one hand called the king, on the other hand calling a thief. So the Gemara says, yeah, everything's relative. Gabi achashersh listem hu, gabi listem dalma melechu. Relative to whom are we describing? If it's relative to the king, so then he's a listim. Relative to other listim, he's considered a thief. Relative to other thieves, he's considered a king. Okay. Anyway, we're gonna stop over here. This is a perfect place to stop. Let's quickly recap. Okay. Our first part of today's daf, we finished off the discussion of the Gemara that when the daughters are being supported by the estate, which is part of tonight's suva, so is there a lien going to be held against just the properties or even movables as well? A major debate amongst Amoraim, amongst Tanaim. The Gemara's conclusion is it's only the obligation is only being held against properties, not against movables. That's the Gemara's conclusion. Even though normally we say the halacha is like Rebbe, here the halacha is not like Rebbe. So that is point number one. And then point number two is that the base minimum of 200 niksuva, is that a hard number? Is that a soft number? Can a husband write a ksuva for anything less than that? Our Mishnah says unequivocally no, absolutely not. Now, if she wants to waive some of the ksuva, she can do so. But in other words, but the face value of the ksuva has to be at the base minimum of 200, 100 for a basula and for a ba'ula. And then the Mishnah says, and I, what if all of his properties are not securing the obligation? In the ksuva contract, it only says that one of his properties is securing the ksuva obligation. All of his properties are there to secure the ksuva obligation. That's Tanai Basin. And not only is that Tanai Basin, that's true by every note holder. Every note holder is going to be having a lien against all the properties. But the Mishnah made the point regarding the ksuva. The Gemara had basically, effectively, two discussions. One discussion was, who is the author of the Mishnah? It sounds like the beginning of the Mishnah is going like Reb Meir. It sounds like the end of the Mishnah is going like Reb Yehuda. And the Gemara didn't like that inconsistency. So the Gemara said we can have the whole Mishnah going like Reb Meir or the whole Mishnah going like Reb Yehuda. There are ways to learn the Mishnah in one of two different ways. And finally, our last discussion that we had, a real adult discussion, regarding a woman who was violated, but over the course of the act, it turns from being a forced participant to a willing participant. What is going to be her status vis-a-vis her husband? So machlok is between Avu Deshmol and Rava. Avu Deshmol says that Tchilaso be'onis v'sofa beratzon is considered ratzon. And therefore she's going to be prohibited to her husband. A difficult position, but the position of Avu Deshmol. And Rava says no. And Rava says even if at the end of the act she says crazy things about how she's interested, Rava says no. That's it all falls under the category of ones. She will not be prohibited to her husband. She'll be permitted to her husband.